Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. Over a distinguished 40-year career as an academician in finance, Daryl Duffy has made important contributions to our collective understanding of how markets work. Earning a PhD from Stanford in 1984, Daryl has taught finance there ever since and now serves as the Adams Distinguished Professor of Management and Professor of Finance at the Graduate School of Business. Along the way, he's written several books, authored countless papers, and provided guidance to policymakers who have sought his counsel in addressing complex regulatory questions. We review some of Daryl's research over the past four decades, starting with equilibrium models of asset pricing in the 80s, term structure models in the 90s, and work on default correlation post the GFC. We spend most of our time on his recent research on the U.S. Treasury market, that risk-free asset class that recently appears anything but. Daryl shares some conclusions from analysis of the meltdown of the bond market in March of 2020 and the policy implications that result. First, he states that yield volatility explains a large proportion of the breakdown of liquidity in what should be the world's most liquid asset class. Higher vol and compromised liquidity generally go hand in hand. Daryl and colleagues show that the bond market freeze could further be traced to dealers reaching their capacity to warehouse risk, a factor that impacts liquidity in a highly nonlinear manner. We shift to the policy recommendations that arise in light of his research. First, Daryl notes that a campaign of large-scale asset purchases is considerably more effective in combating a volatility episode when dealer balance sheets are stretched as they were in March of 2020 than the market turbulence of 2022 when dealers had space to absorb additional risk. He also points to a greater need for centralized clearing in the Treasury market, a mechanism that would provide much-needed netting of risk exposures. Lastly, Daryl shares some new research he's engaged in, specifically exploring the 2024 Treasury program to buy back securities. I hope you enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Daryl Duffy. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Daryl Duffy. He is the Adams Distinguished Professor of Management and Professor of Finance at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford. Professor Duffy, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Dean, it's a pleasure to be here, and I hope you're not going to call me Professor. Just please call me Daryl.
Just once. Well, we'll have a lot to jump into here with regard to your long and very distinguished career in academic finance and theoretical markets, but also really focused on empirical issues in markets as well. So we'll have a lot to get into. You're just about to celebrate your 40th year at Stanford and your 40th year since receiving your PhD, a fantastic accomplishment. So I'd love for you to just get us started and kick things off. Someone like yourself who's contributed so much to the body of research in markets and finance, I'm always curious if I speak to someone like yourself, how you got started. Where did the interest develop? Did it sync up for you immediately? Just tell us a little bit about the early days for Daryl Duffy and how you established such a passion for research and exploration in finance.
Dean, the passion has been there from the beginning, but it's not unusual for a fresh new PhD to be interested in theory because I don't know that much. I started mostly working on the theory of financial markets, but as time passes, you start to blend in some knowledge of how markets actually work and develop some set of topics in which you have a policy interest. And over time, people are willing to talk to you about their interests. And longevity alone now brings us to the point where I'm pretty much steeped in a lot of the policy issues that are facing financial markets. And my theoretical work, while it continues, is now really much more relevant because it's driven by some really important current policy concerns about the way financial markets work.
It's interesting that you characterize it that way, that someone who is a freshly minted PhD is sort of trying to find their footing in terms of how markets work and is making contributions more in the theoretical side. And as I went through just some of your papers organized chronologically, it seems to me if I were to just broadly characterize some of the commonality by time period, as you said, the 80s seemed to be more equilibrium models, just the kind of theory of asset pricing. And then towards the late 90s, I see some term structure models. Post the GFC, I see work on things like default correlations. And then, of course, more recently, and this is going to really be the backbone of our conversation, this interest in exploring, I guess I'll just call it the robustness of the risk-free asset class, the treasury market, which in some ways is seeing better days with regard to liquidity. But I also just increasingly see you really tying in the policy implications that markets aren't perfect. There's bound to be some gaps in terms of market clearing. And it seems to me that you spend a lot of time thinking about the policy implications. And I would love to maybe just start there with you kind of framing this out. Obviously, we'll talk a lot about the treasury side, but if you could talk to us about maybe one or two other areas where your study of markets leads you down a path of really thinking about what policy implications might be relevant to some market friction, market failure. Talk to us about that outside of the treasury complex.
Sure. Happy to, Dean. Well, it's not like theory is left behind. It's still equilibrium theory is driving this. And I'm just right now working on a theoretical model of equilibrium in a treasury market. But what happens is you learn that markets are not perfect, as you mentioned. And the theory to be relevant needs to consider the fact that dealers that intermediated some of the most important markets, like currency markets, treasury markets, corporate bond markets, commodity markets, and so on, swap markets, they have balance sheet costs. Those are affected by capital requirements, by liquidity requirements, and by the leverage that they take. And all of that needs to be incorporated. So just for example, I'm very interested in the breakdown of covered interest parity in currency markets that we've seen since the financial crisis. I can walk through that briefly if you like. That's a pretty interesting phenomenon. Since 2008, we're seeing big arbitrages opening up at every quarter end in the foreign currency forward market that we didn't see before, for at least for decades before the financial crisis.
Yeah, it's a great one because in a lot of ways, it's kind of the most basic arbitrage that you think would be not really possible, right? Just effectively borrowing and lending money at different rates to lock in profit. But what you're pointing to, and certainly myself sitting in front of a Bloomberg screen for way too many hours a day, you'd look at metrics like the cross-currency basis swap. I want to say this really started to open up during the Eurozone sovereign crisis in 2011, kind of became a thing in Japan years later. So why don't you maybe walk through the basic underpinnings of why it shouldn't exist. And then as you explain away how it emerges when it really shouldn't, at least in a theoretical world of no arbitrage, what's causing it to gap out like that?
It's caused by the fact that banks need to meet their capital requirements at quarter ends, particularly foreign banks. U.S. banks, by the way, have to meet their capital requirements on a rolling daily average. So they're not so much affected at quarter ends. All the time they have capital requirements to meet, but you don't see the impact of that on the cross-currency basis. On a daily basis, it's too small. But at quarter ends, big foreign banks that need to refinance their positions can't really borrow in dollars very easily. They have to turn, or they can't borrow on behalf of their clients. They have to turn down a lot of possible arbitrages in the foreign currency market. Let me break it down pretty simply. Let's say it's a Japanese bank. They can borrow directly in dollars, which is very expensive for them, or they can borrow indirectly by borrowing in yen and swapping it back to dollars. And it turns out that that's much cheaper for them because borrowing in yen mark is much easier for a Japanese bank and it doesn't blow up their balance sheet as much. So at quarter ends, you can see 50, 75. You watch the numbers. It's been widening again just recently. Basis points of spread where it should be zero. Actually, Dean, this spread, the cross-currency basis, was first noticed by John Maynard Keynes way back in the early part of the 20th century, because in those days, markets weren't very efficient either, and there were arbitrages like this available. But then in the 80s and 90s and the early part of this century, banks got very efficient at arbing that spread, and it was driven practically to zero. Then the financial crisis hit, and regulators got religion about making sure the financial system is safe, and they required banks to be much safer, imposed capital requirements that make adding assets to your balance sheet to close this arbitrage makes that a negative return for shareholders, so they just don't close the arbitrage. And the foreign banks, still subject to quarter ends, just basically pull out of the market and cause the basis to widen quite dramatically at quarter ends in many currency pairs. And that's been a subject of quite a lot of research. I would mention the paper by Wenxin Du and her collaborators, Tepper and Verdelin. They have a famous paper in the Journal of Finance that points out the big emergence of this cross-currency basis since the financial crisis. You're right, it did widen out, especially in the European sovereign debt crisis, but it's been wide on quarter ends ever since the GFC.
And so really, it's not as if people fell asleep at the wheel and just aren't taking count of money that's being left on the table. What you're pointing to is a regulatory response that introduces certain distortions, I suppose, or certain frictions that make the cost of trying to chase after these basis points either more than they're worth, or they're not able to close the market just in terms of getting the spread down to zero, as you pointed to in the pre-GFC era, just because of the regulatory response to the GFC. Is that fair to put it that way?
That's right. I mean, in terms of the P&L, the profit and loss on this trade is still quite big. But the issue is these banks are not being run just for P&L. They have to give up some of that P&L to their creditors, and the shareholders get what's left. And of the cross-currency basis trade, the P&L, the part of it that goes to shareholders is negative because it's costly to finance. Let me give you a simple example. Suppose I'm a large bank and I fund for, let's make it a year to make calculations easy. I fund at a year wholesale unsecured spread of 50 basis points. If I go into the cross-currency basis market and I pick up a risk-free arbitrage that effectively has me adding 30 basis points of profit to my balance sheet, how do I do that? I have to borrow, let's say, $100 million. It's risk-free, so at the end of the year, I'm going to get $100 million plus the 30 basis points of profit, but I borrowed at my own unsecured spreads, which is 50 basis points. I have to give up 50 basis points. That means it's a negative 20 basis point deal for my shareholders, even though I added 30 basis points of profit to my balance sheet. And that economists call this debt overhang. It's an idea that came into economics in the 1980s, was introduced by Professor Stuart Myers of MIT. And ever since then, it's been a way for economists to think about how profits to the balance sheet get split between shareholders and creditors.
When we started our conversation, I had noted that you got your PhD and started teaching immediately at Stanford in 1984. I'm a little student of derivatives history, so I'll note that the first interest rate swap ever was done in 1981, IBM to the World Bank. But we had a vastly, vastly less complex system, much smaller financialized system than we do now. And so that introduces a lot of things, right? We can argue that the financial crisis in 08 itself was really a function of the products inside the markets that run amok. We're at the 25th anniversary of LTCM. There's another implosion internally within the market. It's not like the economy hit a brick wall or there was some war or spike in oil prices. It was really carry trades that went bad. So we've got all these new actors in the market, these new products in the market. How does that, just over time, I'd just be curious, as you are studying a system that's innovating, it's changing, maybe it goes through periods of being de-risked and safer versus amped up in the 2005 and 6-7 period leading into the crackup of the GFC. How do the changes in the system itself impact your study of markets? Does it lead you down a specific path? I'd love for you to reflect on that for us.
Terrific. Well, let me give you a case example that I was involved in, which was the switch away from LIBOR which is the London Interbank Offered Rate. You mentioned the first swaps in the 1980s. That market grew to about $600 to $700 trillion notional of LIBOR-based swaps, plus many other LIBOR products, as you know. And as you know, it was discovered that some banks were cheating on their LIBOR reports, partly because they didn't want to reveal how costly it was for them to borrow during the financial crisis, and partly because there was individuals inside some banks that were just corrupt, and they were exploiting the opportunity to report wrong LIBOR numbers to make profits on swap trades. When that was discovered, the authorities internationally decided they wanted to make this transition. And that introduced a whole set of policy issues and research issues for me. By that point, I was fairly seasoned in financial markets, and the regulators asked me to chair an international committee governed by the Financial Stability Board to decide what to do about LIBOR in terms of what should be the replacement reference rates. And after a lot of to and fro with committee members all over the world in asset management firms, large banks, large dealers, and buy-side firms, like corporates that were borrowing at LIBOR, we thrashed around for a while and came up with the idea that for the rates market, like the big swap market, you don't really need a credit-sensitive rate. So we recommended that we move to a risk-free overnight rate, which is now called SOFR, the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, which is based on the overnight repo rate. They have about $1 trillion of transactions every day with which to fix that. So it's really robust in comparison with LIBOR. After that transition was made, I got involved in a lot of research on what are the implications of robust reference rates? Does the transparency of the reference rate matter for market liquidity? It does. And how hard is it to manipulate a reference rate? What is the optimal way to design a benchmark against manipulation? And most recently, I've been doing two new projects on the fact that there's still a place for credit-sensitive reference rates in the lending market. If you have a moment, I'd explain why there's still a role in the lending market for a credit-sensitive reference rate and why LIBOR is not the answer, but there are other possibilities.
Please.
Okay, so I wrote some research with collaborators at the New York Fed, one of whom has now come to Stanford to join our PhD program, Harry Cooperman. Another is Stefan Luck. He's an economist at the New York Fed. Another, Zachary Wang, is my PhD student here at Stanford. And the last co-author is Yilin Yang, who was a PhD student here and is now at Hong Kong. And we discovered that there's a massive amount of corporate borrowing on revolving lines of credit. These credit lines are actually a larger source of corporate credit than plain term loans, a fact that I hadn't known before this work. About $1.5 trillion of corporate credit is provided in the form of credit lines. And when there's a crisis like COVID or in the GFC, corporates draw massively on those credit lines to store up cash. And when they do that, the banks have to fund the draws on those lines. So in COVID, for example, there was over $300 billion suddenly drawn on credit lines by corporates in March of 2020. Now the bank has to go out and borrow to get that funding. And if it has to borrow at an unsecured rate, then the offset coming from the credit line being at a credit-sensitive rate will help with that funding cost, and it will reduce the incentive of the corporates to borrow, because if LIBOR or the credit-sensitive rate is going up, then corporates won't draw as heavily as if it's a risk-free overnight rate, which is a great deal when bank funding costs are very high. So in that application, it would be better not to use the secured overnight financing rate. It would be better to use a credit-sensitive rate. And in some other work that I did with collaborators in Australia, Antje Berndt and Yichao Zhu, we designed a new credit-sensitive rate, which instead of focusing on 3 months or 6 months or 1 month, it just collects transactions from all across the curve, from overnight to 5 years, And so there are plenty of transactions if you do that, and then you can average the credit spreads on all of those and come up with an average credit spread that's very robust because it's based on tons of transactions and is highly correlated with bank funding costs. If you do that, then you can have a robust credit sensitive rate for the corporate lending market. You can keep SOFR for the rates market, the big swaps and other risk-free rates market, and you basically meet both objectives. So far, though, the market hasn't yet taken up a credit-sensitive rate. The transition to risk-free rates is pretty much done, but I'm hoping that market participants will consider the fact that for certain applications like credit lines, it makes sense to use a robust credit-sensitive rate.
Let's go back to LIBOR for a minute. And as you note, of course, it was subject to manipulation. I mean, it's kind of staggering in hindsight to think about the manner in which this data was collected. And so you've got a more market-based, much more market-based system now. And you said something that I wanted to explore a little bit, which was around the rate not being easily manipulated. And so I'm just thinking about the repo market, and in no way suggesting it's manipulated, but we've had accidents, so to speak, right? We had the repo market blow up in 2019. I think it was September of 2019. That was a reserve shortage. You have certain securities go on special at different points in time. What's the mechanism for ensuring that your reference rate is robust, it's market determined, but it clears within reasonable levels without necessarily asking, let's say, the Fed to come in each time and kind of backstop? When the levels clear at wayward prices, is it just going to be necessary for the Fed to have some backstop vehicle or some program to guide the prices back towards some equilibrium level?
Well, the Fed definitely doesn't want to be responsible for arbitrating what should be a benchmark index when there's not enough transactions to fix it. So it naturally went to the repo market. The rates of the Fed reports out of the repo market called SOFR are extremely robust, totally non-manipulable. Many, many transactions, $1 trillion a day. So if you wanted to move that rate, you would have to give up a lot of money. If you want to trade so as to manipulate a rate, you have to be willing or find a willing counterparty that's going to trade way off market, which is very expensive. So that's one of the criteria for a robust reference rate, that it's based on a deep pool of transactions. In fact, that's what IOSCO, which sets the standards for benchmarks internationally, requires as one of its key standards for benchmark indices, is that it's based on a deep pool of transactions. LIBOR had two problems, actually. Not only were there not many underlying transactions, but it wasn't based on transactions, at least not at all until about 5 years ago. And then about 5 years ago, only partially. It was based instead on the benchmark administrator calling each bank and asking a designated person, if your bank were to borrow today, hypothetically, how much do you think you would have to pay in interest at each of these maturities? So it was totally an opinion-based poll rather than transactions-based. And that's just rife for manipulation, because if you get a person whose moral fiber isn't that great reporting, and then you get some other person with a similar problem on the swaps desk calling up and saying, hey, if you were to report a high number today, I would probably make a lot on my swap position, and I'll take you out to dinner, or I'll get you a bottle of champagne. And by the way, those are two exact examples of what happened. So the IOSCO is absolutely right. You shouldn't have a benchmark unless it's based on a deep pool of transactions. And LIBOR, despite best efforts after it was discovered to be corrupt, it was cleaned up in terms of governance, but there wasn't enough transactions. Banks are not borrowing that much at 3 months anymore. And you really have to go right across the curve, in my view, and get all the transactions. Bloomberg tried. They put out a substitute for three-month LIBOR called BSBY, B-S-B-Y. It was optimal from the viewpoint of what was available, but there just was not enough available in terms of transactions. They scraped the earth basically to get a good reference rate, but there just wasn't enough there. Gary Gensler was very critical of BSBY, and eventually IOSCO, in a very unusual move, declared that BSBY didn't meet its standards. And IOSCO almost never does that because it's only a standard setter. It's not really regulating or picking winners and losers in terms of benchmarks. But in this case, it did. I guess it was sufficiently concerned.
Well, it is fascinating to look back. And I've read The Spider Network, the book on the LIBOR fixing. And it's really interesting that I would argue that a lot of this rigging occurred in plain sight. This is not the topic of our conversation, but I do think it touches on regulatory regimes. You know, the sort of pre-GFC period was a pretty light touch self-governance type of regime, which in some contexts has some benefits, but certainly in this one, where again, as you state that I needed to fix here, so can you put that in your survey? There was obviously a lot of that. And as we said, the regulatory implications of markets seems to really be a thread throughout a lot of your work. And so what I wanted to focus on mostly in our conversation is your work on the treasury market. But before that, and maybe I guess related to it, I would love to get some of your take on Silicon Valley Bank. I know you've done a lot on that front as well, just with the kind of evolution of the banking model and the maybe risks of the speed with which capital can crowd in and move out just as fast. Maybe you can summarize just the SVB debacle from your perspective and what you've learned and what you think the regulatory implications are.
Sure, happy to, Dean. Well, I think your listeners are probably quite familiar with what happened in that large uninsured depositors withdrew their deposits so rapidly that the bank collapsed in a matter of a few days. This is unheard of, to have so much deposits leave a bank in one day. It had never happened before this spring to that magnitude. Continental Illinois, which was the previous largest and most sudden bank run, had a much smaller fraction of deposits leaving on its worst day. What's changed? Well, technology, for one thing, in that now with social media, if you're a large depositor, you're going to find out almost instantly that your bank is in trouble, if it is, from your peers and from media. And with digital banking, you can move your money at a moment's notice. There is an analyst report from Barclays by Jacob Goldberg that shows that over the last 12 years or so, the number of clients of the three largest US banks that have access to digital banking has increased from about 30 million to about 120 million. That's just three banks. So with this change in technology, you're going to expect that when a bank is in trouble, it's not going to make it if it has a lot of uninsured deposits. I mean, there are lots of other reported problems. They had bad risk management. They had invested in a lot of treasuries at a very bad time just before rates went up, and they had not properly marked. I mean, they were meeting accounting rules, but accounting rules were not sufficient in terms of the regulations and the way that the accounting loss in value of their securities was brought through into their capital. And therefore, they escaped higher capital requirements, which was quite alarming with respect to the supervision. Those mistakes are going to happen. What you really want to do is make sure that there's no contagion. I think that's the most important thing that regulators have learned since this spring, is that even though a bank might not in and of itself be systemic, you might have to declare a systemic emergency and bail out uninsured depositors in order to prevent this contagion from going to other banks, which it had started to do. And the Federal Reserve declared an emergency under the Federal Reserve Act, Section 13.3. And it used that in order to provide emergency funding to other banks and to stem the tide of depositor runs at other banks. And it was successful in doing that. But that's not satisfactory, to rely on a last gasp lender of last resort. In my view, the best fix among the fixes, the most important, are increasing capital requirements, which are in process, and improving the lending of last resort access of banks like Silicon Valley Bank, which had difficulty even taking advantage of Federal Reserve lending to it because it hadn't positioned its collateral at the Fed's discount window, and therefore it couldn't get money fast enough. My view is that large banks should be required to have collateral positioned at the Federal Reserve's discount window to the extent that they have large amounts of uninsured deposits. And if that were true, then depositors at other banks would not see the need to run because they would know that their banks are required to have sufficient liquidity from the Fed if need be.
It's a really difficult question, and I think you posed it in the remarks you made around Silicon Valley Bank. I think you gave a speech, but you essentially said if there's any whiff of uncertainty and there's a sense that others might run, well, I'm not being compensated for not running. It's not like we're earning a gigantic amount of interest on our deposits. And I would say that the manner in which a depositor evaluates his or her deposits is not, hey, I want to get rich off these. It's basically, look, I just want to store the money there. And I certainly am not expecting a big return, but I certainly need it to be there for me. And 250, obviously, specifically with respect to Silicon Valley Bank, 250K, I mean, is just so low, right? It's a really difficult question because you'd like to have a store of deposits that's well in excess of 250K. I mean, even for a small business, meaning payroll, you're going to be pretty far north of that. And again, it's not as if a small business has the time or the skill set to evaluate the creditworthiness or the risk management capabilities of the bank that they're storing their deposits at.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you don't want to increase deposit insurance to an unlimited level because then those depositors that are sophisticated would take advantage of going to whichever bank offered the highest rates and never paying any attention to the credit quality of the bank. So I think while unlimited deposit insurance would cure the contagion risk, it would cause very inefficient banking, would be a bad idea. And that's why I mentioned the idea of requiring that banks have sufficient liquidity from the Fed by putting their collateral at the Fed in advance.
Well, let's move to your important work on the Treasury market. I'll set the stage for me personally, being in markets for a long period of time. That period in March of 2020, even with respect to the GFC, was volatility I had never seen before. The S&P had three straight days where it moved in excess of 9% on a close-to-close basis. One of those days was 12%. And of course, the U.S. Treasury market broke down as well. So you had this joint crash in stock and bond markets. And you certainly can't have the risk-free market so susceptible to breakdown. And so you and some colleagues have done some really interesting academic work on connecting that volatility episode to liquidity, to dealer balance sheet usage. And then you've got some policy prescriptions that come out of your research. So why don't you set the stage for us? Just how did you get interested in this particular topic? And then perhaps give us an overview of your findings.
I'm happy to, Dean. Well, I've been following developments in the Treasury market since the early 1990s, focusing first on the repo market and then later on the term structure of Treasury interest rates. But as you say, March of 2020 was a total wake-up call with respect to the ability of the U.S. Treasury market to weather a storm like the COVID crisis. On March 12th, when the World Health Organization declared COVID to be a global pandemic, basically, on that day, the Treasury market wasn't working properly. I mean, as you said, both the stock market and the bond market were gyrating wildly, but at least the stock market kept working, whereas it was very difficult to get trades done in the Treasury market because their balance sheets were basically filled with positions that they had absorbed from customers and they couldn't take much more. And they started offering terrible prices. Bid offer spreads went out by a factor of 15 or more. Market depth on the interdealer market plummeted from about 180 million to between 5 and 10 million. That's the quantity that you could get executed at the best three ticks on your side of the limit order book. Many other indications suggested that the treasury market basically became dysfunctional. And that, as I said, was a wake-up call, not just for me, but of course, regulators who are responsible really began to understand how important it was to improve the resilience of the U.S. treasury market. In my view, it's a matter of national economic security because, after all, this is the world's safe haven. It's the method by which the U.S. government funds itself, and we know what happens when the government is unable to fund itself. I mean, there are legislative issues, but the treasury market needs to work as a minimum condition on the government being able to fund itself. This is, after all, the world's most important security market. It's often said to be the deepest and most liquid market in the world, and it is almost all the time, but it's also the most important single security market in the world. So now you have four government agencies, the Federal Reserve Board, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Treasury Department, and the New York Fed writing a series of reports called Interagency Working Group Reports on what they're doing to improve the resilience of this market. And they've been holding conferences every fall at the New York Fed. The one for this year is coming up in just a few weeks. In my work, I've focused in some work, again, with collaborators at the New York Fed, because I was on sabbatical last year to do exactly this work. These are Or Shakhar, Peter Van Tassel, Michael Fleming, Frank Keane, and Claire Nelson. So they and I wrote a paper that went deep in terms of all the best available evidence on many measures of liquidity in the U.S. Treasury market. We put together 18 different metrics on liquidity, and we related those to what was causing liquidity to get so bad in March of 2020. What we discovered is that almost all the time, liquidity is just a function of volatility of rates. It's remarkable. About 80% of the variation in illiquidity is explained by interest rate volatility. So that was a surprising fact. But even more surprising was when that relationship breaks down, as it did in March of 2020, it breaks down because dealer balance sheets are too heavily loaded with customer positions and they can't take any more. So all the normal determinants of liquidity drop away in importance relative to the capacity of dealer balance sheets, which are constrained now because of post-financial crisis regulation. It's good that we have capital regulations that keep the system safe. That's a primary concern. But there's one capital regulation in particular called the Supplementary Leverage Ratio, or SLR, that's really playing havoc with the ability of dealers to make markets in U.S. Treasuries. Indeed, in March 2020, the Fed exempted the dealers from the SLR insofar as Treasuries and Federal Reserve deposits. And you might ask, well, why do we need a capital regulation at all for Federal Reserve deposits? Because they're perfectly safe. And I agree, we don't need a capital regulation for Federal Reserve deposits. That's why the Fed had to exempt it, because the dealers were just overburdened with reserves as the Fed began to buy treasuries from them and load them up with reserves to pay for them. That helped, but it still took weeks before the market came back towards normal. And that's just not acceptable. So in my view, there are two or three major proposals coming out of regulators that should be adopted, the most important of which is the Security and Exchange Commission's proposal for central clearing in the U.S. Treasury market. Less than a fifth, or about a fifth, of trades in the Treasury market are centrally cleared. The others, you're just relying on one counterparty performing to the other with no clearinghouse to guarantee the trade. And that's not only unsafe for such a large market with such volatility, but it also misses the opportunity to net a lot of purchases against a lot of sales and reduce dealer commitments. Dean, if you're buying 120 million from one client and you're selling 100 million to another client, you have 220 million of gross settlement risk. If you were to clear those two positions, 120 million buy, 100 million sell, that means in net, you're only buying 20 million from the clearinghouse, which is a much smaller commitment. And it makes much more efficient use of your balance sheet to do that netting down. That's one of the reasons that central clearing is good. And another reason is that once you have central clearing, maybe not every single trade has to go through a dealer, as is the case today. Maybe all-to-all trade could start to take a hold on the U.S. Treasury market, and we wouldn't depend only on highly regulated dealers for capacity. You could also get some capacity from all-to-all trade platforms. So the central clearing would be number one on my list. There are other measures that we could talk about that should be brought in. And my research shows that the most important missing element in the market is intermediation capacity under stress. The dealers are just not big enough and their balance sheets are not flexible enough. And that's the most important thing to fix in the market right now.
I had mentioned that we're at the 25th anniversary of the LTCM unwind. And one of the things that was a big project in the aftermath of trying to unwind this behemoth of a portfolio was, I want to say it was 100,000 line items or more of swap trades all overlapping, that there was a giant project to net these trades down. You know, of course, these were OTC bilateral trades that probably complicated the system quite a bit.
You're absolutely right. And this idea that such a large market like the swap market should be centrally cleared came in after the GFC. And despite all the moaning and groaning about costs and that it would be the end of the market is fine. Bid offer spreads are about 1/10 of what they were. Volumes are just as big or better. The advent of central clearing does not kill a market. And I think that's a crucial point.
Yeah, I think so as well. Of course, my own business is focused on derivatives and specifically listed options and the fungibility to be able to open with one counterparty and then close with another. It just creates a stronger framework for clearing prices. Going back to this connection between yield volatility and liquidity, you've got a couple of different measures of, I guess, what let's call them illiquidity. But as you alluded to, the connection is very strong. You suggest that a yield volatility explains 80% of illiquidity in a market. And I just wanted to say that the time series that you show of these two against each other and the way in which illiquidity spikes so much more than yield volatility during that March 2020 episode, it's a striking chart because these two metrics are so on top of each other, but for that period. And so on this topic of balance sheet usage, which you argue and kind of prove out through statistics, walk through how you measure or sought to estimate the degree to which balance sheets were being used. I know there were a couple of different approximation approaches you and your colleagues used.
Yeah, terrific. We worked on that so hard. And when the result that you described came out, we were quite surprised at how clear this relationship is. So with respect to how we measured loading of dealer balance sheets, we used a number of metrics there as well. One of the things that we did, which was kind of obvious, was to look at the both gross and net positions that they had in bond markets, not just treasury markets, because fixed income desks at the largest dealers are loaded up not just by treasuries, but also by mortgage-backed securities, which are very, very large, and to a somewhat smaller extent by corporate bonds. So we went basically to the large fixed income markets and looked at total inventories, both gross and net. We duration adjusted and risk adjusted those so that they reflected the amount of risk that the dealers had. In addition, we looked at the amount of incoming flows from customers that they had on a given day and on the 2 days before. So total flows over the trailing 3 days, again, risk adjusted. We also looked at value at risk because those bond positions and flows don't reflect any hedging. that the dealers may be doing, and value at risk does. And so we got, although we couldn't publish the individual dealer by dealer names and numbers because they're highly confidential, my colleagues at the New York Fed are allowed to look at those, and we aggregated those data on value at risk from each primary dealer. And all of these metrics basically support the same conclusion. It doesn't really matter that much which one you look at. In March of 2020, they were all at peaks in terms of the sample that we looked at. And they all showed heavy, heavy loading. The same thing happened, by the way, in the GFC. We were able to go back, not for every metric, but for many of the metrics, and measure balance sheet loading and illiquidity in the GFC. And the same thing happened. The normal close relationship between volatility and liquidity broke down because of heavy dealer balance sheet loading. And when the dealers are getting up near their desk limits or division limits on how much risk they're allowed to take, given the capital requirements that they face, and also given the economic risk to their shareholders of taking excessive risk, they basically don't make markets very well anymore.
Yeah, I'm remembering just conversations I was having with clients and industry colleagues in the days leading into that. And I'm going to get the exact date wrong, but I'm going to say March 16th, the Fed issued a statement effectively saying, I want to say the words were, we will buy securities in an amount as necessary or as needed, essentially an unlimited amount of QE. What I was hearing from folks that are very active in those markets at very large buy side firms were that, just as you suggest, the dealing community was running out of the incremental capacity to warehouse bonds. They were done. And one of the stats that comes out of your research is this nonlinearity of the way in which, once you get to a certain degree of balance sheet usage, the connection between yield volatility as an explainer of illiquidity starts to break down. And I think it was 40% or more in terms of dealer balance sheet usage, but I found that to be a really interesting component of what you found as well.
Yeah, that's right. The elbow in the curve is around 40%. Below that, there's almost no dependence of illiquidity on balance sheet usage once you control for vol. But after you load up past 40%, then it starts to climb rapidly. It's roughly a squared relationship, highly nonlinear, as you mentioned. I remember that March 16th speech by Chair Powell. And what struck me was, first, as you said, it was basically unlimited. He didn't say unlimited in the cash purchases, but he basically gave the correct message that the Fed would step in to try to restore market function. He made it very clear that this was not quantitative easing in the normal sense of monetary policy, but rather that it was specifically designed to free up space on dealer balance sheets. And it did, to a large extent, but it was an enormous $1 trillion of purchases in the first week of Treasury securities alone, not even counting all the agency mortgage-backed securities that the Fed bought. And they continued buying at a rapid rate. So that's really important. In some other research I did with Frank Keane at the New York Fed while I was on sabbatical there last year, we discuss conditions under which a central bank or a finance ministry, depending on the country, might want to step in and try to restore market functionality by purchasing government securities from dealers in order to free up space. And I think you're seeing systematically the willingness of central banks to consider that. If you've watched recently some of the work of coming out of the Bank of England and speeches by Andrew Hauser, I think you'll understand that central banks view it as one of their financial stability mandates to do this, to step in and, if necessary, purchase securities when the market becomes too unstable, because that can risk systemic breakdown or deepen a crisis.
And just running with that, one of the policy implications that you cite is just around how effective stepping in with regard to large-scale purchases is going to be. And you point specifically to 2022, which was a year of extremely high volatility in treasury markets. Of course, it's a year of rapid transition to try to get to neutral, 500 basis points of increase in the short rate. But it's also a period when balance sheet usage was probably on the lower side. So high vol, low balance sheet usage implies less effectiveness from a Fed intervention or buying securities in terms of limiting or lowering the overall volatility in the market. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, if you could imagine that dealers are making wide markets, big bid offer spreads, because they're worried about the vol, well, then having the Fed step in to buy securities won't necessarily reduce the volatility if it's coming from fundamental monetary policy uncertainty. People are uncertain about where rates are going to be, or there's geopolitical risk. It's not a balance sheet problem. And so in that case, the central bank stepping in wouldn't necessarily help. I mean, of course, if the Fed were to buy enough securities and do something extreme like yield curve control, which they did in the middle part of the last century, then sure, they could control treasury yields, even if the problems were only caused by volatility. But that's not what the Fed wants to do. It doesn't want to blow up its balance sheet to hold yields at a certain place, like the Bank of Japan has been doing for many years. The Fed would like to see markets set those rates. But when markets are not functioning properly, well, we saw the Fed is willing to step in and make sure that markets can work if need be. My view that I expressed earlier is that we should improve the market structure so that we don't need to rely on the Fed to do this. Central clearing would be the most important step, and other steps could be taken to improve market structure. And then the number of occasions on which the Fed would need to step in would be much reduced. Moreover, it's not like when the Fed steps in, instantly the problem goes away. The Fed came out guns blazing in mid-March of 2020, and it wasn't until mid-April when treasury market liquidity was restored. The central bank hasn't got a magic wand that it can simply wave to cure this market dysfunction. It's really up to financial market structure and then relying on the Fed as a last resort.
I step back as someone who looks at prices all day long. I certainly find the very rapid increase in long-term interest rates, let's just target the 10-year, I think are increased by about 100 basis points over the last 3 or 4 months. It's fast and set against deficit spending that doesn't seem to really have an end in sight. These markets have got to find a buyer. They've got to clear at a certain level. And the implied volatility of options on longer dated securities, of course, it's not 2020 levels, but it's just much, much higher than you'd like to see it. And so, you know, I don't know if that's a regulatory issue, but it certainly feels like a precarious time for the risk-free market.
This is a fiscal policy problem. Everyone has been saying the U.S. government is running excessively large deficits. And of course, in an emergency, it needs to spend a lot of money, like in COVID or in the GFC. But it seems like the deficits are coming without end. The Congressional Budget Office projects $46 trillion. That's nearly double the current stock of treasuries by 2045. That's remarkable. Even before that, 2035, if I have the number right, and reaching 150% of GDP, treasury debt, by 2050. That's really crazy. And it's not really the Fed's problem here. This is basically the government needs to either be willing to pay a much higher interest rate on its debt, which investors are going to demand if they have to absorb that much, or it's going to have to reduce its appetite for deficits. This is totally a fiscal problem. What the Fed and what other regulators can do, though, is to ensure that financial markets can at least keep functioning when volatility comes into such a large market. That's up to the official sector as well, to try to keep market structure resilient enough to handle the flows that investors want to trade at these crisis times.
Yeah, totally agree. It's a really interesting and important topic for all investors. This is the base asset around which so many things are priced, and it's got to function properly. Well, Daryl, this has been a fantastic conversation. I'm really pleased that you took up my invite to talk about some of this important work and for us to be able to talk a little bit more about your important contributions to the world of theoretical finance, empirical finance, the policy implications. One last question, just as we round out, you have a lot going on, a lot of projects going on. Is there anything on your research docket that may be off the beaten path or something you're particularly excited about that you might share with our listeners?
Well, yes, I'm very, very excited about a new project on buybacks. The Treasury Department has just recently, in a speech by Assistant Treasury Secretary Joshua Frost, has announced that it's going to begin buying back Treasury securities. And I definitely want to understand, first, what is the cost benefit on that? And secondly, if you were to buy back, how would you do it? So I'm starting some new research. It's too early to discuss the initial stages of our findings. And I'm not going to talk about who my collaborators are yet because I haven't asked their permission to do that. But I'm very excited about this new project. And I hope if you invite me back someday that we can talk about Treasury buybacks. And I want to say, Dean, what a pleasure it's been to speak with you today. I know that you are, like me, basically sharing knowledge in a way that's very, very important. You have many listeners and you have many very, very important and helpful commenters that speak to you on your podcast. So thank you for inviting me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for taking the time and consider the pre-invite already there. So when you finish your work on buybacks, we'll circle up and have another one of these conversations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dean.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again and catch you next time.